in. You're in. If you're in Houston, and probably if you're on the road and coming through Houston, you're probably more than invited to come to the studio. So it's just a great place to get your music out there, and I think it's a great place to be a music listener as well.
Listen for his music and other local artists here on KPFT.
This is Steve Earle, and you're listening to KPFT Houston Pacifica Radio for Peace.
It is 6 p.m. Wednesday and time for award-winning So What's Your Story? The only program originating in Houston devoted to storytelling where every week we place a spotlight on ordinary people with extraordinary stories to tell. And you're going to find them only here on Houston's community station, listener-sponsored KPFT. I am the proud producer and today's host, Hank Rubicek. You know, James Baldwin believed that not everything that is faced can be changed, but nothing can be changed until it is faced. He was speaking about finding ways to stop hate. Bringing hate to a halt requires that we find a sense of connection to one another, to increase our empathy. And this empathy reinforces compassion and kindness. Well, stories do this best. And before you think this claim is sappy, consider science. Because as we connect with characters in a story, our brain releases oxytocin, often known as the bonding or love hormone. It's why we love our furry friends so much. But these stories need to move us, take us to a place we follow these characters and shadow their experiences. Now, there's a lot of storytellers who do this, but none do it better than my guest, Dr. Warren Holloman, retired professor of behavioral science at UT MD Anderson Cancer Center. And this celebrated position isn't the seed of this evening's stories. Rather, it's Warren's remarkable sense of inquiry, research and artistic skills, and relentless hatred for hate that makes his stories special. Warren graduated from Apex High School in North Carolina in 1973. He moved away, but his heart always remained in Apex. A short list of his work, which was born from inquiry, research, and fighting hate, all encased by his love for Apex, include Pluck, Perseverance, and Paint, Apex, North Carolina, Beginnings to 1941, a book written with his equally talented brother Toby. And Byron Pitts, co-anchor of ABC Nightline, offers these words. If you love a story about community and the can-do spirit of small-town America, then Pluck, Perseverance, and Paint is a must-read. And Warren's recent play, Forged in Fire, The Birth of Apex, is based on stories from that book, and he's going to be bringing that play to life in just a bit. Warren's other plays, Beyond the Pale, which is the backstory of Russia and Ukraine, and All Swell That Ends Swell, a farce of Shakespearean proportions, demonstrate his ability to look at worldview from several lenses and apply his passion for story. And why not? Warren's a storyteller. And it is no hyperbole to call him my favorite. I met him at the Moth when he told, no surprise here, a story about experiencing hate as a kid. And he tells lots of stories at the Moth, winning many, because he moves his audience. He gets them to feel things. Warren's a really dear friend of mine, and he's not paying me to say any of this. I'd say it even if he wasn't here. As a matter of fact, I think I have. And his stories have been showcased on Moth Radio Hour, the Moth Main Stage, TEDx, and the Boston WGBH PBS series, Stories from the Stage. Warren simply reminds us that we are human. He continues his interest in the power of human narrative and healing by serving as editor for Pulse Voices from the Heart of Medicine. And for many years, Warren was co-host of this award-winning show, So What's Your Story? And Keisha forgot where you are right now. Storytelling is in his DNA because this summer, Warren and his wife, Marcia, will premiere their own one-man show, The Bleeding Horse, The Pregnant Women, and The Crazy Grandpa, True Tales of a Texas Veterinarian at the National Storytelling Conference, a show dedicated to Marcia's father. He and Marcia are proud parents of two grown children, and they're great kids. I know. I've witnessed them both. I actually know them. And again, Warren's a really dear friend, and I am so glad that he is here. Warren, welcome back.
Thank you, Hank.
I know you
Thank
got a little loss coming here, but those of us who are a little over 40 are very challenged when it comes to getting places. And
I went to the old location.
Well, There's a lot of love there. A lot of love there.
Yeah, Love It Boulevard.
But you know, we don't want to get any more mold, so I'm glad we're not there right now, right? Now, Warren, I know this is a really long intro, but it helps set the scene for what I consider to be really uniquely relevant stories. Your first one is called A Place for Us, one of my personal favorites. Let's just kind of jump into it, and then we can share some thoughts.
Hank, this first story is about my first visit to a gay bar. But come to think of it, being raised a Southern Baptist in the 1950s and 60s, it was pretty much the first time I went to any kind of bar. Back in those days, we were taught to believe there were two types of people. There were church people and bar people, and ne'er the twain did meet. Well, 30 years ago, I was doing this psychology project that involved filming a series of family role plays. I had a friend who was a professional actor. Now, if you've seen the movie North Dallas 40, it's a comedy about the Dallas Cowboys, then you've seen my friend. Grant played the role of the team chaplain, and he was hilarious. After making that movie, Grant continued to have a pretty good career, but then he fell on hard times. He was in poor health, both physically and financially. And I thought, well, with Grant's help, my film would be really good. Plus, that would give me an excuse to pay him some much-needed money. Well, we shot the role plays. Grant did not disappoint. He was such a good actor. And when it was over, I pulled out my wallet to pay him his fee. He put up his hand and he said, "How about you buy me a couple of beers?" So at Grant's direction, we headed south on Greenbrier Drive, and I soon realized where we were headed. The Briar Patch was Houston's first gay bar. By this time, the 1990s, there were others, but this was still the place that the older men preferred. But because Grant had been sick, he hadn't been there in a while. Just before we walked into the bar, Grant turned to me, grabbed my elbow with both hands, and gave me the sweetest, most mischievous smile. Little did I realize, but he was now recruiting me to play a role play that he was cooking up at that very moment. A role play in which Grant would play himself, a happy, flirtatious, and rather queenish older gay man, and I would play the role of his much younger boyfriend. Now, Grant was not in good health, but you sure would not have known it for the next 2 hours. He took me around that bar, introducing me to all of his friends. He was in his 70s. I was in my 30s. His friends were impressed, and Grant was loving it. And by the way, just so there's no confusion, Grant knew that I was happily heterosexual and just playing along, but I don't think the men in the bar knew that. It was our secret. And Grant loved that, too. Well, it was a piano bar. And at a given moment, men started gathering around the piano and singing tunes, Broadway show tunes. They sang with so much gusto, and I stood there awkwardly because I didn't know the words, but I did my best to pretend to follow along. At one point, the pianist singled me out, asked me to sit beside him on the piano bench, and announced he was dedicating a song to me. Then he played a Broadway tune about an old man who takes a young lover. In the original version, the older man took a younger girlfriend. But of course, the men changed the words to boyfriend. Grant was loving that too. Now, there were, to be sure, awkward moments for me, but there was And there was way too much cigarette smoke, by the way, as well. But there was also so much joy in that room and a sense of community. It was a beautiful thing. Then the pianist sort of threw me a curveball and shifted gears. He started playing, of all things, church hymns, Baptist hymns. I knew all the words to those songs. So now I'm singing with gusto. But as I sang, the words took on new meaning. For example, we sang Just As I Am. The idea that God accepts me just as I am. It hit me that these men understood in a powerful and personal way the theology of that hymn. Then we sang softly and tenderly Jesus is Calling. Growing up, I'd sung that hymn 100 times, and I always took its message for granted, but not these men. In most churches of that time, I realized Jesus did not speak so softly and tenderly to gay men. And of course, we sang Amazing Grace. Once again, the idea that God's love is unconditional. But the second verse especially jumped out at me. Through many dangers, toils, and snares, I have already come. 'Tis grace hath brought me safe thus far, and grace will lead me home. I realized that these men leaned on the grace of God to face the very real dangers, toils, and snares of just being who they were. Now I had tears in my eyes, and this time it wasn't from all that cigarette smoke. I realized that these men had been ostracized from most churches, and they had really created one in that bar. After playing several church hymns, the pianist sort of threw in another curveball. He started playing a familiar tune that sounded sacred, but I couldn't quite place it. Then as the men started singing, I realized it was the song from West Side Story about two young people. They had hopes and dreams. They had a love for each other. And they were all destroyed, their hopes and dreams and their love, by prejudice and bigotry. The men sang the song with such reverence, like a prayer, almost like an anthem. There's a place for us, somewhere a place for us. Hold my hand and we're halfway there. Hold my hand and I'll take you there. Somehow, someday, somewhere. That turned out to be our one and only date at the Briar Patch. Grant's health deteriorated and he died about a year later. But I've always been grateful to my friend for holding my hand and taking me there to that place, because that night in that smoky bar, I think I caught a glimpse of heaven.
Wow. I've heard that several times, Warren, and you know, like a good movie that you want to see many different times because you hear different things. It's,
yeah,
that's what this story does. Is the Briar Patch still there?
No, but it's still there virtually. You can go to YouTube.
Oh yeah.
You can Google something, type in Briar Patch Houston Piano Bar, something like that, and I think I've found up to 6 videos of the pianist playing and the men singing. They're not high quality film, but you get a real feel for the joy of the place and the camaraderie.
You know, every story has a lesson, whether we intentionally incorporate one or not. And if there's what is one lesson that you'd like our listeners to take away from this incredible story?
There's something powerful and healing about going to someone else's turf and experiencing life through their eyes, yeah, putting yourself in their shoes, that kind of thing.
Yeah, well, that's
healing for me and healing for them.
Yeah, and that's why I said earlier, I'm glad you said that, because that's why I said earlier in the introduction that one of the things that I love about you as a person and as a storyteller is that you have this ability to kind of leave your body, float up to the ceiling, and understand the power of looking into another lens. Mm-hmm. And I just want to let you know that, and that's something I've always appreciated in the stories that you tell. And it's always apparent, always apparent.
Well, storytelling is kind of an act of empathy because there's a teller and a listener,
right,
and it doesn't work unless
right
each is empathizing with what the other's hearing or saying.
And it's always about that listener. Yeah. It is. Yeah. It's your job to hold your baby is your next story, another one that I love. And I've heard the short version many times. It was told of the moth here in Houston. Now, the long version, first told at the Majestic Theater in San Antonio as part of a moth main stage, is published in The Moth Presents A Point of Beauty, which is currently on the New York Times bestseller list. Now, this rendering is even more stirring, I think. Mm-hmm. Tell us a story.
Sure. My mother had this rather odd belief. She believed that it was wrong to hold a baby. She said holding babies makes them soft, weak, and dependent. She said cribs were much, much better. They fostered independence and self-reliance. To put it bluntly, my mother had grown up in a very difficult situation, an abusive family. And to her, life was hard, and parents did their children no favors by coddling them. The job of the parent was to toughen up the child. She often said, if I hadn't been tough, I never would have survived. If we went out in public and she saw a young couple kissing and cuddling on their child, she would get so upset and agitated. If they held their baby for more than 2 or 3 minutes, she'd lean over to one of us and say, they need to get a crib for that baby. My mom didn't believe in kissing either. I never saw her kiss my dad. And if she kissed me, it was just a peck on the cheek. And if you've ever been pecked by a chicken, which I have, that's pretty much what it felt like. As for my father, he was pretty much the same way, at least during my childhood years. But I don't want you to get the wrong impression. My parents had many fine qualities. They were very good people, but they just weren't the warm and cuddly type. And that had an impact on me, especially as I went through adolescence. I remember having a lot of trouble with hugs and kisses, stuff like that, embarrassing moments, awkward moments. I found myself longing for something, but it was something I couldn't even name at the time. I later learned it was called warmth and tenderness. But I did make it through adolescence, and as so many do, and I got lucky. I met this wonderful young woman, and we got married. About 10 years after that, we found ourselves in the delivery room of a hospital. My wife was about to give birth to our first child. The midwife turned to me at this certain moment and said, get ready. As soon as I catch this baby, I'm handing her to you. Because, and then of all the things she could have said to me, she said, because it's your job to hold your baby. Now, my head was spinning. Part of me honestly wanted to give it a try. I'd seen my wife's family do it. I thought it's maybe one of those life experiences everybody should have. But my head was also spinning because I was sort of replaying the tapes from my childhood. Let's just say I muddled through. I didn't drop the baby, at least. And of all the names we could have chosen for that little girl, we chose the name Annie, which just happened to be my mother's name. Now, the nice thing about having your baby birthed by a midwife in this particular hospital is that you got your own special private suite for the next 24 hours in this place called the Family Bonding Room, or some name kind of like that. And that was the perfect place for me. I got 24 hours to practice holding my baby, learning how to do it, defying my mother, I'm sure, every minute of that time. But even as we were doing that, my wife and I knew that once those 24 hours was over, we'd have to leave that cocoon, that world of wonderful new beginnings, and we'd have to enter a different world I haven't even told you about yet, a world of incredibly sad endings. You see, this was 1987, the time of the AIDS epidemic. Marcia and I lived in Montrose, the so-called gay neighborhood of Houston, and it seemed that every young man we knew was wasting away and dying, and it just seemed so wrong. 20-year-old men, 30-year-old men, we were in our early 30s. These were men our age or younger. There was a pharmacy, Walgreens, on Montrose Boulevard. It's still there, about a block away from where it was then. Over the next few years, it would sell more AZT, that's the drug for AIDS, than any other drugstore in the entire United States. So we were in the middle of what would become one of the worst epidemics in American history. Now, of course, many of our friends and neighbors were dying of this disease, but the one we knew and loved the best was named Chelsea. So I'm going to tell you about Chelsea. Chelsea shared an entryway with us in our apartment enclave. It's actually there where the HEB is today at West Alabama and Dunleavy. And we spent many great times together. When he got sick, he moved into a home hospice arrangement a few blocks away. But we continued visiting and we kept going out to dinner together as long as he was able to. The thing I want you to know about Chelsea is that when he found out that my wife was pregnant, he was incredibly supportive of her. And in fact, he was more supportive than I was. The thing I noticed is how emotionally connected he was to the whole thing in a way that I couldn't even comprehend at the time. Looking back, he served as a mentor for me in my early fatherhood process. He was so excited about the baby and couldn't wait to get a chance to meet her. Well, you probably know there's a rule that after babies are born, there's a period of time they need to develop their immune system. So there were many months passed, but then we were nearing the point when that it was time, and that was when the phone rang. It was our friend Martha. She was coordinating Chelsea's home hospice care, and she said, "I've got some bad news. He's taken a turn for the worse." I said, "Oh, my. Well, we'll be there tonight." She said, "I need to warn you. Something's happened with his mind. He won't even recognize who you are," which was strange. We'd had a normal conversation just a few days earlier. She said, "That's particularly bad because he was so looking forward to meeting your new baby." The other thing she said she needed to warn me of, she leaned into the phone and whispered, "His mother, she's here." And I knew just what that meant. So we went there that night, and this time we took our baby. Chelsea was in the center of the living room where he often was, lying on his back on a hospital bed, which the volunteers had raised the head of the bed up about 45 degrees. Chelsea's shirt was off. He was spiking a fever. And his mother, she was in the far corner of the room, as far from her son as she could possibly be and still be in the room. And she wasn't even facing her son. She was seated on a folding chair, and she was turned sideways. And I tell you, that seemed so wrong, too. I mean, Marcia and I just had this baby, and all we wanted to do was to touch and hold our baby. And Martha, the hospice volunteer coordinator, said his mother would not even touch her own son. As for Chelsea, Martha was right. He did not recognize us, but the thing was we barely recognized him. You've got to understand who he was before he got sick. He was 6 feet, 5 inches tall, the best looking, friendliest, humblest, and I'd say funniest person you could ever meet. Everybody loved Chelsea. But now, as he was lying there with his shirt off, you could see every bone. He was as skinny as a person can be and still be alive. And he also had these awful sores in his mouth, which he kept licking with his tongue, trying to relieve the pain. And so he had this anguished look on his face, which was so un-Chelsea. He usually had this warm, friendly, happy look. Every breath he breathed was a struggle. It took so much effort just to raise his chest up enough to take the air in. And each time you thought maybe this would be the last, and you kind of hoped it might be, he was in so much pain. It was, as for his mind, Martha was right about that too. It was clear that the Chelsea we knew was no longer there. He just sort of babbled his words. He said words, but they didn't make any sense. So we gave up trying to talk with him, and we stood around him and talked over him to each other. It was me holding our baby, my wife, and then the two hospice volunteers on the other side. As I was standing there, Chelsea started doing this one thing that got our attention. He was not strong enough to turn his body or even his head, But he turned his eye. Through the corner of his eye, he started staring at our baby. He was so intrigued by this little creature I was holding. And we were kind of thinking, oh, that's kind of cute. But then after a while, he did another thing. He would focus his eye on our baby, and then he would move his eye back to center for a couple of seconds, and then he'd jerk it back over. He was flirting with our baby. That was so much more interesting than whatever we had been talking about, that we gave up our conversation and we just watched Chelsea flirt with our baby. And then I remember thinking, and I think my wife did too, what does his mother think about all this? She was sitting there staring at the floor. Her son was making a connection with a little baby, but she hadn't even noticed. So my wife and I, frankly, were offended. I mean, we felt sorry for her. It was an awful situation. But it was just, how could she do this? So there, in a marriage, I guess you'd say every once in a while, both sides of the relationship have the same idea at the same time. It doesn't happen very often, but this was one of those moments. Together, we took our baby and we laid her face down on Chelsea's chest. Her face fit perfectly in the cavity of his long neck, and her little alligator arms kind of dangled around his bony chest. And we stood closely by because we had no idea how he would react to this. And at first, what he did was kind of scary. His arms started jerking around, and he had long arms. And we realized it was having a spasm. He was trying to remember how to use them. Finally, after a few seconds, he started getting control, and these long sort of scarecrow arms began reaching up, up, up toward the ceiling and up over our baby. And then his hands, his big hands, folded over and formed an arch over our baby. And then his arms began to relax, and they settled down around our baby in this just very gentle, warm caress. And as his arms relaxed, his breathing relaxed, his facial muscles relaxed, he started looking like the old Chelsea. He was contented. He was happy. And I've often said, if that's, quote, all that had happened that night, it would still be one of the most memorable moments of my life. But one more thing happened. Chelsea spoke, and this time his words made sense. I still remember exactly the moment. He said, Annie. And then he smiled. And then he said, came to see me, Annie. And then he repeated that again with the smile. We went home, went to bed. In the middle of the night, I woke up. I had this huge jolt of energy. I didn't want to wake up the others, so I went out to our back steps and sat there with our dog. After about an hour, the sun came up, and then the phone rang. It was Martha, the hospice coordinator who had called the day before. She said, I'm sorry to bother you so early. I wanted to call you even earlier, but it was the middle of the night. But I wanted to tell you two things. One, that was so incredible that you came last night. I'm so glad that Chelsea had that reunion with you and your baby. And then she said, the other thing is, I wanted you to know that he died at 4 a.m. Chelsea died. Now, we could do the math, but this was around 1988. It was 1988. So it's been a long time. I've had a long time to think about this. I don't think I'll ever understand in a scientific way exactly how a person with advanced dementia suddenly has this moment of clarity and, I would say, humanity. But what I believe, what I'll always believe, is that it has something to do with the healing power of human touch, which is exactly what you get when you hold a baby.
Yeah. Wow. Yeah. I've heard that before, but again, it is a story is so inspirational. You know, that magical transformation inspired by love, really prompting coherent thoughts, his need to say something that was clear and concise to a baby, right? Clear and concise to a baby, right?
Yeah.
And yet his mother, a city there, didn't even want to look at him. I'm sure didn't even want to be there. That's just unfathomable. Mm-hmm. How do you feel when you tell that story?
Healed.
You do?
Well, I don't mean to sound Pollyannish, but, you know, it's a traumatic experience to have to be 32, 33 years old and have a friend who's your age die and have an entire population die. It was a traumatic period for our generation.
Yeah.
And there was something he did in his last words, maybe the last words he ever spoke, that provided me a sense of hope and healing.
Stories heal.
Yeah.
They do heal.
Yeah.
This is Hank Rubicek, and you're listening to So What's Your Story with my guest teller and former co-host on this show, Warren Holloman, on KPFT, Houston's community station, 90.1 FM on the dial, HD1, 89.5 in Galveston, and 91.9 for our friends in Huntsville. You know, the power of story is a message that our teams here on the show have been driving home every week since 2008. I think that Warren's stories tonight really provide that profile as clearly as possible. The Houston Storytellers Guild, our proud sponsor, is a great place to reinforce the power of story. They meet virtually on the fourth Tuesday of the month from 7 to 8:30 p.m. So visit their website at HoustonStorytellers.org for the Zoom link to all the story swaps and for information about upcoming events. A lot of you listening in are not living in the Houston area, not even living in the state, but that doesn't mean you cannot be a member of the Houston Storytellers Guild. It is online. Also, consider becoming a member of the Tejas Storytelling Association. You can check out the details at TejasStorytelling.com, TejasStorytelling.com. The National Storytelling Network is a great place for a more intensive storytelling experience. And we're going to be actually referring to NSN in a few minutes. And our friends at the Moth are at the new Warehouse Live in Midtown. The second Tuesday of the month, they're doing their thing. It's a great date night. So if you got nothing to do, no place to go, go there. And if you don't like your date, you don't have to talk to her, right? You don't have to talk to them. Just sit there, laugh, and listen to stories.
You'll give her a good story to stand up and tell next time.
Yeah, no kidding. And also, please visit our So What's Your Story at Facebook.com/So What's Your Story and let us know if you have any guests, even if that means you. Because if you shoot us an email at sys@kpft.org, I'm going to get back to you, and we're going to talk a little bit about you becoming a guest on this show. Warren, you're an excellent playwright. You know, you and I have worked together with your plays, and I can say that with great confidence and conviction. Beyond the Pale, Salvaged Letters, just to name a couple, but point to those essential lessons that we tend to forget. And you know, for me, I learned that when my children, my grandchildren think of kindness, generosity, and tolerance, I want them to think of me. I live by that. At least I try to. So let's move to stories from Forged in Fire, the story of Apex, North Carolina, inspired by yours and Toby's book, Pluck, Perseverance, and Paint. Give us a little bit of historical background, first of all.
Yeah, sure. I grew up in a small town. It used to be a small town. It's grown a lot since then, called Apex, North Carolina. It's a farming community about 15 miles southwest of Raleigh. It was founded just a couple of years after the Civil War. In terms of demographics, our area of the county had equal numbers of white people and black people. That's an important statistic to keep in mind as you hear this story. Yet when I was a kid reading through the old newspapers, the old town minutes, and what few histories there were of the area, you got the impression that black people didn't even exist. So when I wrote this play, I did a lot of research to try to uncover the stories that had been hidden or whitewashed in my community. And it involved a lot of oral history interviews with white people, elderly white and black people, black especially. And one of the amazing historical figures I learned about was a man named Columbo Wayland Matthews. That was a mouthful, so folks just called him CW. In the play, his story is told by four different actors, actually one actor and three actual family members, descendants, who represented their family and told the story. And tonight I'm going to be one person and tell it. Should I go ahead with
Absolutely.
It? Okay. CW, he was something else. He was a brick mason, he was a carpenter, and he was an entrepreneur. But he was even more than that. He was a pioneer and a leader. In the 1870s, CW built, owned, and operated one of the first stores in downtown Apex. It was a general store, and he operated it well into the 20th century. This was remarkable for a person of color of that era. In the 1890s, when there was no decent school for children of color, no public school, CW built one himself with help from the other men in the community. They called it the Apex Normal and Collegiate Institute. It was a private school, and thousands of Apex children were educated there. After the Great Fire of 1911, which burned down the entire downtown Apex, CW helped rebuild downtown. He owned two of those buildings, and he leased them out to white businessmen, and those buildings are still there today. If you went there and visited downtown Apex today, you could see the beautiful bricks that he laid way back in 1912. Now, you would think that someone so generous and so successful would be the most appreciated man in town, you would think. Unfortunately, these were Jim Crow times. CW was forbidden from using the front doors of his own buildings. Imagine what that was like. He built those buildings, he owned those buildings, and yet when it came time to collect the rent, he had to go to the back door and knock and wait. He could have used the front door, but if he had, that would have been the last time he ever collected any rent. The Klan would have made sure of that. In learning about CW, I spent a lot of time trying to figure out how did he manage to keep his cool. I decided CW had superpowers. In fact, two superpowers. The first was his knees. He must have had incredible knees. Most brick masons do because they spend a lot of time on their knees. But CW, he did double time on his knees. He was a man of faith, a praying man. I think it was the kneeling that gave CW the strength to stand. CW's other superpower was his sense of humor. There's a funny story still going around our town about a time when CW's friends started teasing him for having a hole in his pants. I'm guessing it was in his knees, and that's because he had spent so much time on his knees. You know what CW said? Nothing, not a word. He reached in his pocket, pulled out a $20 bill, and plugged up that hole with that $20 bill. What he was saying was, I may have a hole in my pants, but at least I got money in my pocket. That's a funny story. Now, this next story is not funny. Remember the Great Depression? Remember the run on the banks, the crash? Well, when the bank in my town was crashing and there was about to be a run on the bank, the bankers did the, quote, courtesy of the businessmen who had the biggest shares of money in there, the courtesy of notifying them to come down and get their money before the crowds arrived. They notified all the white businessmen. They did not notify CW. He lost $10,000, which I've looked it up. It's almost $250,000 in today's. And his family said he came home and cried like a baby. And I'm guessing that had something to do with why he left town. He moved to Raleigh, which was the bigger city. He still would visit Apex, but he left. His wife had died about that time also. But even when he moved away, he was an old man at this point. He was alone, but he never stopped doing good things, and he never stopped doing great things. I'll give you one example. In 1933, George Washington Carver came to Raleigh to give lectures at Shaw University and North Carolina State University. At that time, as you know, Dr. Carver was one of the most famous people in the whole world. When this famous man arrived at the train station in Raleigh, guess who was there to welcome him and to serve as his host throughout his visit? C.W. And during his visit to Raleigh, where did Dr. Carver stay? He stayed at C.W.'s house.
Wow.
Yeah.
No kidding.
Yeah. Yeah.
That's remarkable.
Yeah.
That is remarkable.
Yeah. I knew that C.W., the family, it was oral history through the family about him hosting Carver, but I went into the newspapers.com and found the date that Carver visited, and it fit just right with the family story.
Man, that's incredible.
Yeah.
The play was performed at the Halley Theater in Apex. So the play's 8 performances were sold out several days before the play opened. The theater said this was the first time that ever happened. Congratulations, man. I got to tell you, it says so much about you and the Apex community. I don't want to embarrass you, but why? What made this play sell out so fast?
I think people were hungry to hear the Apex story. The town has an amazing story, and it has hundreds of amazing stories, actually.
Yeah.
And people wanted, I think people really do like history, and they do like celebrating. We didn't whitewash the problems of the past, but we showed how people came together and fixed a lot of them, too.
Yeah. History, God, is so much that we have to know now, and we don't. You thank your mother, Ruth, for teaching you the importance about visiting old people. People like us, right, Warren?
Yeah.
Yeah. How to ask questions and to conduct oral history. And, you know, I love this because, as you know, I do a lot of this. Raised by my grandparents, they taught me how to respect and spend time with people. And they taught me the importance of asking the right questions and create a supportive climate. You know, do the right thing, make them feel comfortable, and to really access accurate information in order to conduct oral history the right way. What was her prescription? What was your mom's prescription?
I love that term, you prescription. So if I could state it that way, I would say that, first of all, you visit people on their turf. You go to their homes where they feel comfortable.
Right.
You honor them by doing that. That's a Southern thing. You don't go to the coffee shop or whatever.
Right.
I mean, second, you listen. You just shut up and let them talk. They don't have many people who will do that with them, so they appreciate that. And trust is built, and the more they talk, the more they tell.
Yeah.
And then the third thing, most important, I would say, is don't be in a hurry. Don't say, I can only stay 20 minutes.
Right.
Just be willing to go with the flow.
Right, right. Well, you know, I don't want to deviate too much from this, but this is a really powerful prescription because it deals with something that we in this culture don't do well at all, and that's be an active listener. One of the things that I learned about being a communication specialist is that we listen at about 14% accuracy. We're the worst listeners in the world, and that's the truth.
Yeah.
I mean, that's just a behavioral fact. We are more concerned about what we want to say rather than what the other person has to say. We feel compelled to look at our watch while the other person is speaking. We can't shut up because we think that somehow what we're about to say is going to be so profound and so much more relevant. And it just does not work that way. We don't listen actively. So I love that prescription because it really takes something as valuable as listening and puts an activity to it, gives it an image, something that we so rarely do. And just one more word about this. One of the reasons why we're not very good at it is that when we're kids in school, we're not graded on listening. Mm-hmm. I mean, what teacher do you know walks up to a kid and says, you know, Warren, you look like you're sensing and interpreting and responding to all kinds of sensory stimuli today. Let me put a star on your forehead. No. You know, we raise our hand. Ooh.
Yeah,
and even if we have nothing to say, if you've got your hand up and I'm sitting behind you, I'm going to push it down.
Mm-hmm.
regardless of what you're about to say, I want the star on my forehead. I want to be rewarded. We're rewarded for talk. We are just rewarded for talk. Tell me a little bit about the oral history project that served as the basis for your Apex history book and play.
Sure. Actually, why don't I just, I'll tell my mother's side of it. There's my mother's, what she did for me. There's what my father did. When you're a kid and you have to go with your mom to visit old people, it's not the thing that kids generally like to do. But she took me to visit a lot of very interesting people. This was the time of the centennial, 1973, and we were doing research for that. And I was a high school student. But I'll give you an example. We went to see Miss Ursula Roundy. Now, anywhere else in the world, she would be called Ursula, but in eastern North Carolina, she was Ursula. So we go down to this little country store near where my dad had grown up. He was lifelong friends with the family. And my mother said, tell us about, you know, who has stayed at your tea room. She had a little restaurant called a tea room and a cabin, a motor court, on old US 1, people, the, quote, rich people from New York going down to Florida for the winter. So she started talking about Babe Ruth. Now, as a kid who played baseball, that got my attention. And she told lots of great stories about how much he would eat and cooking for him. But the one that really, you don't know really what's going to make an impression on somebody. The thing she talked about the most was the fingernails of the woman he was with. She said, well, I've never seen a woman with red fingernails, especially that those big red fingernails. Like, that was a little bit out there for Southern ladies, I guess. But she said all the women just came in. They had to see those fingernails. I don't know if that was Babe Ruth's wife, girlfriend, or what. And then she started talking about Bonnie and Clyde, the time they came through. And naturally, I'm going to listen to that one.
Yep.
She said, the first thing that happened, we saw a carload of people. It was at least two men and two women, maybe a little bigger. And they went around to the back. Now, everybody always parks out front. They probably fill up with gas. These people went to the back. And then the second thing, the men did not come and register for the cabins. The women did. That never happened back in the 1920s and 30s. And then the third thing was, they, of course, signed the name John Q. Smith or something like that. She said that was more common. But so we knew something wasn't right. So her husband had the foresight to put them in a cabin that was two cabins that were way in the back, cabin number two. A teenage boy got suspicious and snuck by their car one time and saw it was just loaded with rifles. Wow. And so we did a little research, and they figured that was Bonnie and Clyde.
Wow.
They would go on road trips after crime sprees to kind of let things cool down. And Bonnie loved Camel cigarettes, and her bucket list item was to go to Durham and go to the Camel cigarette factory. Yeah, so I figure she may have gone there too.
That was just down the road. Right. Wow. Yeah. That's amazing.
Yeah.
Listen, I know there are a lot of stories that you want to tell, but I want to get your wife involved. I want Marcia, another Dr. Holloman, to get involved. And by the way, she is the iconic family doctor. I mean, she would make Marcus Welby look like a selfish SOB. You know what I mean? Your wife. I mean, that's how magnificent she is.
She is.
I just wanted the world to know that because she really is. And, you know, you're doing something with her this summer. You're going to be telling stories and the bleeding horse, the pregnant woman, and the crazy grandpa. True Tales of the Texas Veterinarian. We don't have a lot of time, but have you got a story that you can tell us in about, you know, 4 or 5 minutes that would give us a taste of what you're going to do?
I'll do my best.
Okay.
So I'm going to tell this story in the voice of my father-in-law, the veterinarian, the way I heard him tell it. This Texas accent, best I can do. This is a story about Fidel Castro, but it didn't take place in Cuba. It took place right here in Texas, over in Wharton County. That was the county just to the west of Brazoria County, where my father-in-law practiced veterinary medicine. This story was told to me many times, by Frank Mann, a veterinarian in Wharton. He was my classmate at Texas A&M Vet School. And I've also heard it many times from his younger cousin, Billy Mann, who was a neighbor of mine in Brazoria County. One Saturday afternoon, back in 1962, the two of them were going fishing. They loaded their rods and reels, hooked up the truck, and headed south toward Matagorda Bay. It was about a 60-mile drive from Wharton. About halfway there, Frank stopped the truck on the side of the road, and his younger cousin, Billy, who's just a teenager, said, "What's wrong?" He said, "Dang it, I forgot. I was supposed to give out health certificates on this farm, Johnny Ferguson's farm, quarter horse farm. If one of his horses was to die over the weekend without a certificate, then I would be involved, and that would be the end of my veterinary practice here in Wharton County." Now, you got to understand, Johnny Ferguson was maybe the most famous quarter horse rancher in the world. He had his horse, Go Man Go, had set the record for the quarter mile in the 50s. That record has not been broken to this day. So he had the fastest horse in the history of the world, and the most expensive, too. And he had a bunch of mares who were equally valuable. So, of course, Frank Mann turned around and went back there. And while he was checking the horses and filling out the certificates, his younger cousin was just hanging out in the barn. He was a young man. This was 1962. Remember what happened then? The Bay of Pigs, Cuban Missile Crisis.
Right.
So Johnny Ferguson, this rich, famous man, comes into the barn. He's drunk. He's cussing real bad. And he walks up to this teenage boy, and he started unloading on him. He said, "Last year, I promised that blankety-blank Fidel Castro that I'd give him a colt out of Go Man Go. I didn't know that blankety-blank Castro was a blankety-blank communist. Do you think I should still give him that colt?" Now, Johnny Ferguson was an intimidating figure, and this young man was just like 17 or 16 years old. He was too young to have a clever answer, so he just said what was in his heart. "Sir, I believe a promise is a promise, and a man should stand by his word." Well, 30 years later, Johnny Ferguson was dead, and Go Man Go was dead. So we're now in the 1990s. Johnny Ferguson's daughter was living in Houston. She was a wealthy woman, lived in a nice neighborhood. She got a knock on her door. It was a stranger, but she was well-dressed, so she opened the door. The stranger said, "Ma'am, you don't know me, but Dr. Frank Mann, the veterinarian in Wharton County, told me about your father, and he recommended I come talk to you." Now, the wealthy woman invited her inside. She said, "Ma'am, my story has two parts. The second part involves your father. The first part is that there's a couple, a husband and wife, who are missionaries from our church, the Presbyterian Church. They've done nothing wrong, but they're in a prison in Cuba because Cuba's a communist country. Our church has done everything we can to get them out, and we've failed. Dr. Mann told us a story of how your father once did a favor for Fidel Castro, how he gave him a colt out of Go Man Go. Do you think you might have some influence on Fidel Castro?" So the woman said, "I don't know, but I'll try." So she got on the phone. She went through several operators. She got Castro's secretary. She explained the situation. She said, "Is there any way I could speak to Mr. Castro?" The secretary said, "I don't know. I'll see what I can do. Hold on the phone. Don't hang up. It may take some time." 30 minutes later, Mr. Castro himself came on the phone. The daughter identified herself, said, "Sir, my father gave you a colt out of Go Man Go. Do you remember that?" He said, "Oh, yes, of course. At the time your father sent him to me, I already had a stable of 300 horses. I didn't really need another horse, but your father's horse became my favorite. He's the one I rode in all the big parades. He was a wonderful animal for me." Then she said, "Sir, I have a problem. You have two people in jail. They've done nothing wrong. They went there to help your people. Is there any way that you might get them released?" Castro said, "I don't know. I will call you. It's Saturday. I'll call you back Monday morning, 11 o'clock. I'll give you an answer." So they were by their phone. On Monday, the phone rang. It was Mr. Castro. He said, "Your friends will be freed. They'll be on flight such and such at Houston Intercontinental Airport tomorrow at such and such a time."
That's amazing.
The next day they went to the airport, and they were there. Now, isn't it amazing? This is what my father-in-law always said. Isn't it amazing how that happened? That teenage boy wasn't afraid to speak his truth, even to somebody as intimidating as Johnny Ferguson. And because of that, Mr. Ferguson kept his word with Castro. And because of that, even decades later, Mr. Castro kept his word, too.
That's a remarkable story.
Yeah.
That is a remarkable story.
Yeah.
Wow. Okay. Let's take a look at all these stories that you told us tonight. The common.
And I hope I got it in 5 minutes.
No,
I was rushing.
You did. Yeah. We have plenty of time.
Okay.
In about, say 60 seconds, 60 mm-hmm. seconds, 90 seconds.
Okay.
Think about it. What do you want to leave us with? How would you synthesize the themes of these stories? And what would you like us to think about? What's the bottom line takeaway with all of these stories? I don't know, I asked you this with one or two, but what do you want us to think about?
Well,
I know that's a tough question, but I mean, give it a shot.
I think there's a storytelling group that I've just joined. They tell stories called kindness stories. I believe that's the title. And I think if you're a good story listener, stories help you build empathy and be kind.
Yeah.
Maybe that's what I would.
Yeah. Well, I think that's really very powerful, you know, and one of the things, it absolutely teaches you to be kind. I really do believe that. And, you know I deviated a little while ago when I was talking about the power of listening, but people do have to learn to listen in order to be good story listeners. They do.
Yeah.
It's not just a matter of, you know, you go to the Moth and people say, well, that person didn't tell a story as well as I'm about to tell.
Yeah.
I'm going to win, you know.
It's a competition.
It's a competition,
yeah.
Right? It's a competition. But that's similar to what I said earlier about when we're young, we listen and we'd like to think that what we're about to say is more powerful. And you really can't. You know, you can't. You have to be able to listen to everyone as someone who has something really incredible to offer. And you are willing to listen carefully enough to access that. We live in a world where there's more hate than we can possibly imagine. I'm sure you feel the same way. I just can't imagine. I never thought that so much hate would be around, but my God.
Yeah.
Human dignity, understanding that free speech is not rhetoric of hate. It's all about the stories we tell, the stories we hear. Thank you, my dear friend Warren Holloman, for crafting and delivering stories to help us make sense of complex situations, to understand our emotions, and to make sense out of the world. And mostly, thank you for reminding us of our hearts and inspiring us to feel. And don't even anybody think about leaving, by the way, because Michael Woodson and Michael Carson are up next with Living Art, another KPFT exclusive. Make Houston's community station, KPFT 91, 90.1, a part of every day. And be sure to join us every Wednesday at 6 p.m. for So What's Your Story? You keep loving a great story, and we're going to keep bringing them to you. This is Hank Rubicek, and along with the rest of the So What's Your Story team, we never want you to forget that it is never too late to live happily ever after. Peace.
KPFT Artist Profile, Johnny Falstaff.
I think KPFT means a whole lot to a whole lot of people. For me personally, I remember KPFT from way back in the high school days. We were listening to the blues and to King Biscuit, and there was some kind of mushroom program going on at the time. I can't remember what that was, but we were all tripping and digging it. It's a very personal thing, you know, on a very personal level. You can almost reach out and touch it, and it's very inviting to an artist. It's not like an untouchable Clear Channel type of organization where, you know, you're cast out. You're in. If you're in Houston, and probably if you're on the road and coming through Houston, you're probably more than invited to come to the studio. So it's just a great place to get your music out there, and I think it's a great place to be a music listener as well.
Listen for his music and other local artists here on KPFT.
Did you know that the Upper Texas coast plays a key role on the Central Flyaway, an important migratory path for birds? Birds that move along the Gulf of Mexico depend on safe passage through the Houston-Galveston area at night, and lights on buildings can disorient birds on their paths, resulting in fatal collisions. Throughout migration, and particularly during storm fronts, turning lights out for birds can make a big difference. Remember, each light turned out helps save migrating birds. A message from the Audubon Society.
KPFT artist profile, Marcia Ball.
I've streamed KPFT since I could, since I was available and able to do it. And I've also been on Nuri's show. Able to do it, and I've also been on Nuri's show.
Yay!
A bunch, the Boss Man of the Blues.